From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The FDA is considering a procedure that would allow women with inheritable disease to have healthy children by taking some DNA from a third genetic parent. Sound far-fetched? A scientist in Oregon has already produced 5 clean gene monkeys this way. He's seeking permission from the FDA to test his technique on humans. This hour on Point, we look at the controversy around three-parent in vitro fertilization, three-parent babies. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Does this sound like a perfect solution for parents who don't want to pass on inheritable disease? Or does it sound like too much genetic intervention? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Washington is Dina Fine-Marin, Associate Editor at Scientific American. Dina, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So here's the FDA hearings 2 days. They're in the second day right now. And this was announced promising to discuss oocyte modification in assisted reproduction for the prevention of transmission of mitochondrial disease or treatment of infertility. Put it in plain English for us, Dina. What's under consideration here?
Yeah, so at issue here is reproductive technology that would draw DNA from three individuals. The approach is designed to allow moms to have genetically related offspring while circumventing the threat of passing on certain genetically inherited diseases that come from mutations to mitochondria. And the bulk of the discussion has been around oocyte modification, or literally modifying a woman's egg. So in the U.S., this research involves swapping out potentially mutated mitochondrial DNA from a woman's egg and replacing it with the mitochondrial DNA of an unaffected donor woman. Then the egg is fertilized with dad's sperm and implanted back into mom. But you could also do this swap after fertilization occurs, and that's the kind of research that's being done in the U.K. So both of those are under discussion today. What's interesting is these processes are designed to prevent this transmission of these really debilitating inherited mitochondrial diseases that can result in vision loss, seizures, and other maladies. And right now we have no cure for them. So this would be a way for moms to be related to their children if they so desire to have them be genetically related.
So moms can pass these genetically. The children can inherit these mitochondrial diseases. Let's back up here a little bit. What's mitochondria?
Yeah, good question. So you may have learned in high school that mitochondria is the cell's battery pack, and that's true. But mitochondria also have their own DNA inside cells, and they play a number of roles in human development. So mutations to that mitochondria can result in vision loss and seizures, among other maladies, and even death.
So you're saying that in this procedure that they're thinking about, the nuclear DNA of the mother would be preserved, but a donor's mitochondrial DNA would be brought in, mitochondria?
Exactly so. So unlike the nuclear genome, which is derived from both egg and sperm at fertilization, mitochondrial DNA in the embryo is derived almost exclusively from the egg, so it's from the mom.
People talk about three parents. The amount of genetic material from this donor, this third parent, quote unquote, would be very small compared to the nuclear DNA.
Yeah, that is true.
But nevertheless, the offspring would have some of that donor's genetic material.
That's correct. Yes, they would, which is where a lot of the controversy stems from here.
So the controversy is because you've got a third parent, because it's manipulation of the gene. Where exactly does this get controversial?
Good question. So, yeah, a lot of the discussion here is really about the ethics. The challenge is really whether or not you can divorce the two, the ethics from the science, and if that's even possible. Something that people are really concerned about is the sort of slippery slope mentality of creating, in the future, designer babies. The idea being, if we support this kind of procedure where you can swap out mutated DNA for medical purposes, what's to keep us from, in the future, swapping for certain admirable traits or traits that we believe to be admirable, such as intelligence, athletic ability, eye color, and that's really where people are getting concerned. Another area, of course, is the sticky situation of any sort of embryo research. Many people, or some people at least, feel uncomfortable about creating human embryos for research purposes, and indeed, in the United States, since the 1990s, there is legislation that restricts the creation of human embryos or the destruction of human embryos for research purposes with federal funding.
About 1 in 4,000 children born in the U.S. affected with some version of mitochondrial disease, inherited here. I'm reading here, the United Mitochondrial Disease Foundation says many don't live past age 4 or 5, that these mitochondrial mutations can cause blindness, deafness, stroke, seizures, cardiovascular problems. This intervention would break that chain of inheritance, of transmission. This could also be used. It's been considered for use in treatment of infertility. What's that application, Dina? Is that giving young mitochondrial material to older potential mothers?
Yeah, so the jury is still out on the fertility treatment question to some extent. There's no scientific consensus regarding whether the quality and quantity of mitochondrial DNA impacts fertility at all, but some researchers wonder if that strong link exists. So the theory is that perhaps accumulation of mutations throughout a woman's lifetime contributes to age-related fertility decline. So yes, the idea would be akin to what we would do here for preventing the transmission of genetically inherited diseases. You would, again, swap out the mitochondrial DNA of a woman who desires children for that of a donor.
And with that, you might succeed in fertility, in reproducing, though a little bit of that offspring would be somebody else's DNA.
Yeah, that's correct. But right now, the science committee members were saying yesterday and again today, they're not sure that it's really there yet.
This hearing, these 2 days, is not about the ethics of this. It's just about the science. This was moving along in the 90s and was shut down by the FDA. Are they now considering whether what practically would be the result here? If they gave it a green light, what would that mean?
Yeah, so if they did give it a green light, that would mean, and again, right now it's just a committee looking at it, an advisory committee that will report back to FDA. But if they did proceed with it, it would be a clinical trial that would look at, indeed, whether or not women could have children through this method that were free of mitochondrial mutations and also how that impacted future progeny as well. Something people are really talking about today is what a clinical trial would look like, what could be safe, and concerns about if small degrees of abnormal mutated mitochondria are passed down from the actual mother as opposed to the donor, what that would look like for future generations. Could there be some issues lurking there, and how could we get around them? One question people are looking at is, could we get around that by only selecting for male children through this method at first to limit the transmission of mitochondria, since indeed it comes from the maternal line?
But this donor mitochondria, the third parent, quote unquote, that DNA would become a permanent part then of that family line.
Exactly so, yeah.
What are the potential risks here, Dina?
Well, some of the risks that people are talking about that they really want to get further in depth, I think, today is about, indeed, one, passing on bits of the abnormal mutated mitochondria still. And another issue is that, from an ethics perspective, these children didn't have any say, obviously, in whether or not they would be involved. And so people are concerned about that. Those are really the main ones, as well as we'd have to track multiple generations of children in order to detect them. As you mentioned at the top of the program, there has been some research already in monkeys, and indeed these monkeys survived into adulthood disease-free, but we haven't yet looked at their offspring and then their offspring, multiple generations.
But this is getting right into the genetic formula. Of course, you could say this saves a lot of suffering. Why pass on the disease? As you say, the slippery slope argument comes in right here. Dina Fine-Marin has written about all of it for Scientific American. She's associate editor there. Joined us today from Washington. Dina, thank you very much for your insights.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
With us now from Chelmsford, Massachusetts, is Stephanie Bush, singer, blogger, patient, advocate. She has mitochondrial disease caused by an inherited mutation in her mitochondrial DNA that she shares with her mother, aunt, sister, niece, and 10-year-old son. The gene mutation causes many complications, including muscle fatigue, gastrointestinal problems, migraine headaches. Stephanie Bush, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I guess when you were having children, this was not available. If it had been, would you have considered it to keep from passing on these mutations, Stephanie?
Would I have considered this option that
yes.
we're discussing? Absolutely.
Why?
Well, living what I'm living now and watching my children go through what they go through, I would absolutely do whatever it took to make sure they did not have to go through that and feel 1 ounce of what they've had to feel through their very short lives.
What's it been like for you living with these mitochondrial mutations?
It's not been easy. And it's definitely been limiting on the things that I've been able to do with my life, and it's been scary, and the potential for very significant issues to occur, and, you know, potentially taking my life and leaving my children without a mom is a really hard thing to think about.
What kind of symptoms have you suffered, Stephanie, and for how long?
You know, all my life I've had symptoms. They've been mild. You know, I wasn't officially diagnosed until 2010, and ironically, that was when things truly snowballed out of control. And I started having autonomic issues, so my heart rate wouldn't regulate properly. My blood pressure was all over the place. My gut doesn't really move, so I have no motility of my gastrointestinal mm-hmm. tract. And I can't regulate my temperature in the cold. So, you know, it really does impact every facet of my life.
Did you understand this when you were a girl? Did your family, when you were growing up, what was going on?
Oh, no. You know, I was told it was all in my head. and now I can turn around and say, no, it was not in my head. It was in my mitochondria.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about mitochondrial DNA manipulation to avoid inherited disease and more. You may have seen the headlines, three-parent babies. Well, just a little bit, but enough to avoid mitochondrial disease being passed down from generation to generation. It's before the FDA in 2 days of hearings wrapping up today. Advocates say, let's do this. This will save families from a lot of suffering. Critics say this puts us on the slippery slope to designer babies. We'll hear in a moment from an advocate and from a critic. Stephanie Bush is with us right now. She has suffered from mitochondrial disease, and it runs through her family. She joins us from Chelmsford, Massachusetts. First signs, when did this show up? How old were you, Stephanie?
You know, my parents told me that I was sick a lot as a kid, and my first memories myself of having issues was when I was around 13 years old, and every time I stood up, I would get really dizzy and, you know, feel like everything was blacking out, and I had a lot of reduced endurance, but, you know, they just said that I was just going to be a sickly kid.
What about your children? Do they have the same mutation? Do you know?
So my son does. My daughter does not, but she has other genetic defects that they're unsure of what the disease process is truly going on. There's a lot of speculation because of what they just don't know because of genetics.
This was tough enough on you that you really wanted to stop it. As soon as you learned the source of your problems, you had a hysterectomy. You didn't want to risk passing the DNA on. That's a big deal. That's a big step.
Yeah, I did. You know, I mean, I would have loved to have had another child. It was something that we had talked about, having three children. But, you know, my son was impacted, but my daughter was even more significantly impacted. And the last thing I want to do is, knowing that I have a gene defect, pass that down to another child and risk them another child suffering.
You say you would have taken this procedure that's being talked about before the FDA today if it had been available.
Yep.
Of course, that would have involved bringing somebody else's DNA, a little bit of it anyway, into your family line.
Mm-hmm.
Would that have given you pause? Would that have looked like a worthwhile step given the disease complications?
You know, I think unless you've truly lived it, and unless you've seen someone you love more than life itself suffer without a single option to fix it and know that it's going to get worse, I think you can't put yourself in that position. I would absolutely do it in a heartbeat without question, because to me, it would be worth it.
What do you say to critics who say this puts us on the road to designer babies? You start messing here. Yes, it's a heartrending, but if you get into it here, we'll get into it all over the place, and pretty soon we'll choose kids from a menu.
Yeah, you know, I understand I completely can relate to why they're saying what they're saying, but like I said, go visit a family that has mitochondrial disease way worse than what we have, and sit there and tell me that you wouldn't want to stop a child from going through that.
Walk a mile in my shoes, says Stephanie
right.
Bush, a singer, blogger, patient advocate. Stephanie, thank you very much for sharing your experience with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Joining us now from Baltimore is Marcy Darnofsky, Executive Director at the Center for Genetics and Society based in Berkeley, California, promotes the regulation of human genetic and reproductive technologies. Her op-ed in the New York Times yesterday was Genetically Modified Babies. She's against this technology, this procedure. Marcy, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And with us from New York is Dr. James Griffo, Program Director of New York University's Fertility Center. He's also Director of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology at the NYU School of Medicine. In 1998, the FDA sent him and others a letter saying stop work that allowed older women to get pregnant by doing nuclear transfer of their eggs into enucleated donor eggs, the kind of mitochondrial transfer that we're talking about today. Dr. James Griffo, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Marcy, you're kind of laying down across the tracks on this, saying it's a big problem, we shouldn't go down this path. Why not?
Well, let me start by saying that, as we've just heard, mitochondrial disease can be really debilitating, and it can be life-threatening. Children die from it. These are a terrible set of diseases in many cases. But the procedure that's being contemplated here, first of all, in fact, the great majority of people who are affected by mitochondrial diseases aren't candidates for this procedure because they don't have that kind of mitochondrial disease. So these procedures, even if they worked, would not help them.
But some are, and they might be just like Stephanie. You would cut her off from it. Why?
Well, there's a small number of women who would be candidates. I don't know, and I don't know if Stephanie knows whether she would be or not. But in fact, in the discussion this morning with the FDA committee, one of the considerations about how, if we were going to do this, you would design a clinical trial is, would there be enough patients to enroll that you could get a meaningful result from it? So it really is that few.
Let's step past the number because you're opposing this in principle. Please explain for our listeners why.
Well, you know, I was listening to Stephanie and saying, and she said that, you know, no one would want to risk having a child suffer, and of course, especially your own child. But the risks that this procedure would introduce into a child are very significant. And in fact, the chair of the committee yesterday, when he was summarizing the discussion at the end of the day, he said that his first remark was, there's such a great concern for the well-being of any kids who would be born after such procedures. He said that the sense of the committee is that there's not enough data in animals or in vitro at this point to move on to human trials, and that the concerns are about both the limited preclinical data that exist and also the basic science. So it's really not... even before we get to all the ethical issues, which are very, very profound and important, but even before that, which is what the FDA meeting is focusing on, the safety issues are huge. And there are less risky alternatives for women.
You go very quickly to the ethical issues. You did yesterday in the Times. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're backing off of that today, but you were saying you're saying you want all genetic modification of sperm, eggs, and early embryos strictly off limits. Why?
Mm-hmm. The reason that it's important to understand that there's a bright line, both technically and policy, that has been observed around the world for decades in most cases and is actually written into law in more than 40 countries, this idea that we're not going to alter the genes we pass on to our children. The reason that bright line is there is because of the concern that once you permit genetic modifications to what sometimes is called the human germline, you don't have either technically or in policy a stopping point. It, you know, life is a slippery slope, but you do need breaks. You do need stopping points. This situation is maybe better understood not as a slippery slope, but as jumping off a cliff.
Why? What's the problem with it? Please articulate it.
The problem with choosing traits that we pass on to children is that we would get ourselves into a situation in which there were pressures from insurance companies, perhaps, maybe from governments in some countries, maybe from just one sense that you have to keep up with the neighbors to have the child that is the most intelligent, the most talented, the most beautiful, the most handsome. And we could find ourselves in a kind of a high-tech consumer eugenics rat race and wind up in a world like the one shown in the movie Gattaca And I don't think that's a world that any of us want to live in.
Dr. James Griffo, jump in here. We put a foot on this path and down we go to a high-tech consumer eugenics rat race. What do you say?
Well, I mean, I've been hearing these complaints and criticisms since 1988 when we started doing developing methods to test genetic disease in embryos to help patients have healthy babies who are at risk for having babies with severe illnesses. We've been hearing about eugenics as the what we would do as fertility specialists trying to help patients, and it's just not true. That's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to help patients with disease. We heard Stephanie and her suffering. I think it's quite inflammatory, and actually shame on the New York Times for putting that title on this, you know, on this article that was written yesterday. Imagine being that patient and reading that. It's just so insensitive and so lacks empathy. We deal with disease. We see human suffering and we try to solve problems. We did research in animals for many years before we even thought of attempting any of this in human, and it works. We did it in mice. We had mice babies that had babies. They were healthy as far as we could tell. We got to a point where an institutional review board in 1997 actually approved us to try to do these techniques, and we did successfully create embryos this way that did not make pregnancies, unfortunately. The day after we reported it, an article on the front page of the Washington Post talked about the baby with three parents, which is a gross misrepresentation of what's being done. Mitochondrial DNA is a small percentage of total DNA. Mitochondria came into the human genome. It's a bacteria, and it lives happily in our system and has for many years, and my mitochondria and yours aren't different. There's 33 genes that it codes for. It basically makes energy for the cell. And, you know, there's 21,000 genes in the nuclear DNA. So to say that this is a baby with three parents is a gross misrepresentation of what it is. And the fact is there is much more data to say that it's safe. There's been macaque monkeys born from it. There's been human embryo research that's done to show that it's safe. And, you know, we were at the time in 1998, we had the ability to do it. We were stopped by the FDA. I got a personal letter from them telling me to stop my work and threatening me. I think it's pretty interesting when you get a phone call from the Assistant Surgeon General, Susan Blumenthal, who starts the call with, "Hello, Dr. Griffo, what the hell do you think you're doing up there?" after reading Rick Weiss's article. I think there's a little bit, we're a little bit over the top here on criticisms.
Well, let me ask you, Doctor. We get that you're trying to help people, but people, of course, they don't take any intervention into what's passed down genetically lightly. When you hear the suffering of our guest Stephanie Bush in her family and that inherited, it's hard not to be really sympathetic to that and to want to relieve that suffering. To be clear, the research you were doing was not for, as I understand it, mitochondrial disease, but to help older women reproduce, have babies, when the mitochondria of younger women might help them do that. Is that correct?
Well, what we were trying to do is help people do donor egg without losing their genetic material. They wanted their, you know, when you tell an older patient whose eggs have failed to successfully result in pregnancy that their next option is adoption or egg donor, it sounds good. But if you're the patient, you have to understand what it feels like to be that patient. And patients want their own DNA, and that's what drove the technology. It was funded by a patient. We spent $500,000 in private research money developing it in animals before we tried it. We did everything ethically correct and according to procedures. We got institutional review board, and yes, we were helping that group of patients. But their suffering is underestimated in general because most people assume fertility and most people have it.
Yeah, no, I don't want to make light of fertility issues at all, but you know, people are very sensitive on this front. We've got listeners right now writing in online, doctors, saying, you know, watch out, money, that's what this is really all about, nothing more. They're looking at in vitro fertilization clinics and turning this in, as Marcy says, to some kind of consumer product, not necessarily for the immediate relief of a family who's got inheritable disease.
I mean, I can't comment on that. It's ridiculous. We've lost more money working on that technique that we never were able to use. To say that it's about money is ridiculous. It's about patient suffering and helping patients. We spent 25 years working on methods to help patients. Those criticisms are unfounded and not based on any reality.
Let me go to our callers. Lee in Boston. Lee, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to make the point that, I guess, first and foremost, the idea of the DNA involved in the new offspring is a bit silly since we're, you know, generations of DNA. So you know, at one.
Lee, you're breaking up, but I think I got just enough there. And Marcy, let me bring it to you. Lee saying this is silly. We're all kind of a cocktail of our ancestors' DNA. You add one little bit of different DNA. What's the big deal? We've all got ancestors we never met.
Well, yes, but by that logic, is there something so terrible about using a donor egg and avoiding these terrible risks to the children that would be introduced by so many aspects of these manipulations? And, you know, this committee of many experts who have a lot of experience with in vitro fertilization and a lot of experience with mitochondrial disease were overwhelmingly very concerned about the risks you would be introducing to the child.
Well, that's their job to think about those in these few days. But how do you know there are such terrible risks? Like what? What's the proof that there are such risks?
Well, for example, it's true that one variation of this technique created the monkeys who have not yet grown into an age where they can reproduce. So we don't know the effect on their offspring. That would be something to look at. But the same research team that created the monkeys also worked with human materials, and the human zygotes that were created, half of them displayed serious abnormalities that were not observed in the monkeys. So there's differences between species. It's hard to disentangle the safety and the ethical concerns. And an ethical question is, do we have enough evidence of safety to proceed? And my sense and the sense of the majority of the committee members was tending toward no.
Dr. Griffo, the human zygote abnormalities that have been reported in some research, what about that?
Well, it's very clear that most embryos in the in vitro fertilization lab and at home in bed are chromosomally abnormal. There was no normative data for those studies. So, of course, the embryos that made the offspring were healthy, and the ones that didn't weren't. That's a ridiculous criticism. Most embryos are chromosomally abnormal. That's why we struggle so hard to get people pregnant. Finding that one good embryo that's chromosomally normal to make the baby is what we've been working on for 25 years, and we're getting much better at it. And in fact, we use the technique of embryo biopsy to test embryos to find chromosomally normal embryos, and we've now solved a lot of the problems of IVF. We can put back one single healthy chromosomally normal embryo and make healthy offspring without the risks of multiple pregnancy, and that's from 20 years of research of a technique that was criticized exactly the way this new technique is being criticized.
It might be worth the risk to head off mitochondrial disease being passed down. Is it worth the risk at this point, Dr. Griffo, simply for reproduction?
Well, that's not for me to decide. It's not for you to decide. And I'm not sure who
it's the question we're here to ask. We're not deciding, obviously, but we're asking.
I think when you do what I do and you sit in an office and you see human suffering, patients should be allowed to be involved in these decisions. And currently, the way things are, they're not involved at all. They're told what to do by regulators, by ethicists, by everybody else. They don't get a voice, and there's no voice for them.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about mitochondrial DNA manipulation to avoid inherited disease and more. The headlines around this have been three-parent babies. Marcy Donofsky joins us today from Baltimore. She is with the Center for Genetics and Society based in Berkeley, California. Very much against this. Sees it as a first step on a slippery slope toward all kinds of genetic engineering of offspring, designer babies, she says. You can read her essay at our website or link to it, onpointradio.org. Dr. James Griffo is with us, program director of New York University Fertility Center. He's been deep in this since the 1990s. Got a personal letter from the FDA back then saying basically cease and desist, but he sees suffering that could be alleviated here. He'd like to do it. Lots of response online. Fred says, I work with children who have genetic disorders. If someone wants to spare a child of theirs pain, suffering, and early death by ensuring they don't carry the mutations that cause such difficulties, I'm good with that. Clarita says anyone seriously contemplating this needs to ask themselves how important it is to pass on their genetic material. For someone with mitochondrial disease who doesn't want to pass it on, why not use a donor egg? Other listeners ask, why not adopt? John goes the other way. He says, I don't see the problem with designer babies. Why not have more intelligent and physically fit children as long as the technology is available to all parents and not just the rich? Let's hear from our listeners right here. Vincent in Midland, Texas. Vincent, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What's your question?
I was wondering, for the donor, what would their rights be in this process?
Rights as a, oh, you're going with the three-parent kind of description of this? If there's a third parent, are there rights? Marcy, how about it?
I think most people would agree that it would be similar to a standard IVF procedure in which the woman that was providing the egg wouldn't have any parental rights over the child. I think we would want to make sure that her health was protected in the egg extraction process, but that's a different question.
What about Dr. Griffo's point that the amount of genetic material involved here from the donor, mitochondrial donor, I guess you'd call it, is so vanishingly small that it's really insignificant in these terms?
You know, my concern isn't around the three-parent aspect of it, but it is really, I think, misleading to say that it's just a tiny amount of genetic material, et cetera. I mean, first of all, there's thousands of copies of the mitochondria in each cell. They have a pervasive effect on metabolism development, especially at the early stages. It's a really a, it's not just a little bit of a tweak. It's a massive genetic transfer, and we need to understand that as we think about the safety issues as well as the ethical issues.
I'll take that to Dr. Griffo. A couple more calls here. Mary in Natick, Massachusetts. Mary, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I also take issue with this, with the characterization that this is akin to, you know, three parents. Because this is, this, you know, argument has already been had with the idea of egg donation or sperm donation. I was an egg donor for a family member, for my sister. And my nephew is my nephew. He's not my son. And, you know, to characterize it that way, I think, plays on people's emotions in a way that's unfair. I can't speak to the safety, you know, further down the line or to the genetic ethics of it. But from the perspective of, you know, parental rights or anything like that, this is an old, you know, an old debate.
Yeah, Mary, I'm glad you remind us of the bridges we've already crossed here in terms of sperm donation, egg donation. That's interesting for our framing and thinking about it. Emotions come in very quickly. Rich in Trumbull, Connecticut. Rich, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. We talk about a lot of the physiological type of maladies, whatnot. How about psychological? What if great-grandfather of somebody, the third donor, was a complete wacko, as Click and Clack would say on NPR? could that be transferred down the line and people would screen the donor, would say, oh, this person, oh, they're a Stanford graduate with a PhD, they're fine, good stock, you know.
Interesting. Back? Yeah, thank you, Rich. Dr. Griffo, what about it? What about, you get some relief here, but maybe you introduce things that you're not aware of in this process.
I mean, we don't understand the genetics of psychiatric illness to any great extent, and how much of it is nature versus nurture is still in question. But donors are screened, and if there's a significant psychiatric history in the family, they're not used. Can we avoid any possible disease? No, we don't understand that. But we don't do that at home in bed, you know. Just because an uncle has a psychiatric disease doesn't mean, you know, the niece can't have a baby. And, you know, the families live with these risks. We take a risk every day, a genetic risk every day we have a conception, whether it's at home in bed, whether it's in the IVF lab. And, you know, nature's pretty good at protecting the species, but it's not perfect. And we have to live with imperfection.
Marcy, what about that argument that at home in bed, reproduction has all kinds of risks attendant to it, so let's not get all bent out of shape about, you know, this deliberate medical intervention?
Well, the purpose of the intervention is to avoid terrible risks, risks of passing on serious diseases. And, you know, if there was a strong medical argument for these kinds of techniques that involved changing the genes we pass on to future generations, if there was a strong medical argument, then the ethical case against germline modification would be harder to make. But that's not true. The technique that Dr. Griffo helped develop, is an embryo screening technique, and we use that now. And of course, there are questions about it and when should it be used, who should we screen out, all those kinds of things. But there's not the kind of bright line there, and I'm not recommending the kind of bright line there that I think we should observe when it comes to actually manipulating genes that we pass on to future generations. And there are vanishingly few situations where germline manipulations would even be considered. And this mitochondrial situation is one of those, but I don't think even there that the the medical case is convincing.
Do you feel the tide pushing against you here, Marcy? I mean, you write, you're very black and white on this. Genetic modification of sperm, eggs, early embryos should be strictly off limits. But here's the FDA with 2 days of hearings, and yes, all kinds of cautions have been raised, but the hearings are on, and there's pressure to do this, and there's mounting capacity to do it, and the United States doesn't control the brake in the end. Do you feel like the tide pushing against your position of a bright black and white line here, Marcy?
Well, no, I actually don't, because there are over 40 countries around the world where this is written into law, where people looked at it. You know, they looked at it in the 90s and the early 2000s, and it was clear. It was that this was the point where people, policymakers, medical experts, legal experts, bioethicists, social scientists, scientists around the world said, look, we can do all these wonderful, important things with our increasing knowledge and understanding of human genetics, but here's something we should not do because of the safety and ethical concern and social concerns about it. So the United States is actually kind of an outlier among developed countries with, you know, high-tech biomedical sectors, countries that actually protect public health and protect reproductive rights.
Dr. Griffel, let me turn that question around for you. If we don't draw a line here, and maybe we shouldn't, but if we don't, where would you draw the line? Or are you wide open for the designer baby highway?
I don't think you can sit down and make a single line policy statement. I think every case has to be individually analyzed and decisions need to be made.
That sounds, in effect, like a wide open highway for genetic engineering,
you know,
of babies.
Tom, it isn't. We're the most highly regulated specialty in the world, fertility specialists, and we keep reading in the newspaper about the cowboys of the Wild West, unregulated.
But when you say each case on its own, that sounds like no line.
No, it means it needs to be considered scientifically and impactfully on society. But here's what I can tell you.
Mm-hmm.
The Brits will do this first, and they are already considering it, and they're
We'll do what exactly, Dr. Griffin?
With this technique that we're describing and talking about that the FDA is considering.
Mm-hmm.
To say that the United States is ahead of the curve, we're not. We're always behind the curve. With embryo biopsy, we couldn't get permission to do it here in the United States till after the Brits had a success. We will be followers and will continue to be followers because of these kinds of regulatory constraints put on us. And not to mention the cost of all the regulation, it inhibits our ability to be successful and develop new techniques to help more patients.
Do you think globally...
It's about helping more patients.
Yeah, I get that. Do you think that globally, genetically modified babies are in an inevitability for some reasons that we're hearing today, which may be very justified, but is this a path we're going to go down globally, Dr. Griffin?
First of all, I'm totally appalled that the term genetically modified baby, that evolution is genetic modification. It happens every day at home in bed. To present it that way is the most inflammatory, caustic way, and it degrades the plight of the patient who's suffering. And we need to think about how we think about things.
I don't think we're degrading that plight today, but evolution has been seen as something in greater hands than human. And now it's right in our hands. And I think that's why people worry about it.
Well, I mean, look, all the techniques that we've developed have been criticized this way every step of the way, and we've made progress, and we've helped more and more people.
Yep.
We could do it better if we had more ability to, but you know, we'll follow the Brits. They'll do it. We'll find out it's okay, because we already know it's okay. It's been done in animals. It works. And that's why at some point you have to take the risk or not, because there's no way you can prove that it's safe. It's impossible. When the FDA stopped us originally, they said to me, you can do this, but you can only do it if you do an investigational new drug application, which essentially means I need to prove it was safe. But they couldn't tell me how to do that.
Yeah.
They didn't fund me to do that, and we stopped the research. In fact, we gave it away to another country, and they did it successfully.
You gave it to China, as I recall.
Yeah, and it was successfully done. But then, unfortunately, the pregnancy ended in miscarriage because of ruptured membranes at 18 weeks, which had nothing to do with the procedure.
Yeah.
And then the American media turned it into, you know, this terrible thing, and they stopped it.
But I think I read that China has also the government there has put a stop to this now.
Well, they did after that case because the woman had a miscarriage. But miscarriages happen in 20% of pregnancies.
Yeah.
But they, you know, no one understood that it had nothing to do with the procedure. The fetuses were healthy. Unfortunately, the woman ruptured membranes at 18 weeks and lost the pregnancy.
Let me go to Leah in Buffalo, New York, if I may. Leah, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Basically, I'm calling in. I have mitochondrial disease myself, and this is exactly the problem and situation myself and my husband are in. I am afraid to have my own child because of passing stuff on, and I feel calling these designer babies and three-parent babies is absolutely disgusting. If the FDA allows this doctor to continue this work, I have hope for my children. I have hope for my family. Without it, basically, I just fall through the cracks, and I'm lost. And to call them a designer baby, I don't even know how you can label it that way.
Marcy, you hear the emotion and the reality Leah's facing. She says, cut it out. This is her family. She wants to have children. This might help her do it. You know, your principle may be a little too high for her. She's dealing with everyday reality and big questions of children, Marcy.
Well, Leah, I really hope that you can get help to have children. I don't know, and I don't know if you know, whether you would be a candidate for these procedures if they were allowed. If you were, I would really urge you to consider very carefully the risks and the long-term risks of a child that would be created by undergoing these very biologically extreme manipulations. There's a lot to consider here. It's a complex disease, as you know more than any of us, Leah, and the scientists who are talking about it today are just, you know, listing consideration after consideration, risk after risk. You know, they're talking about the known risks and the unknown risks. It's not as simple as it sounds. And there's, you know, there are reasons for these regulations and reasons for this level of caution that even before we get to the ethics.
Leah, good luck to you. We really do wish you the best of luck, and I appreciate your call. Let's get one more from Buffalo. Christine. Christine, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is kind of ironic because that was my daughter, and I didn't know that was my daughter.
Oh, my goodness. Who? So she got her mitochondrial disease from you, and now you're on the phone as well.
Yes.
Amazing. What do you think,
yes,
Christine?
Well, I've watched her suffering, and what bothers me is people toss out, well, let her adopt. And when a lot of times they won't allow you to adopt a baby. And the other point I wanted to make was, she takes medication every day that tries to repair her mitochondria in her body and tries to do some of the same things that these doctors are trying to do that are developing these techniques.
Yeah.
You know, very often we said when they developed vaccines, they said the same thing. Well, you don't know the effects of taking the vaccine. So I've just watched her suffer, the suffering we go through as a family. It just breaks your heart.
Christine, what about the concern that's been raised here by Marcy Darnofsky that we don't understand all the risks associated with this, and it puts us on a path to maybe more and more genetic intervention?
Well, you know, everybody's afraid of the unknown in many cases. We don't understand all the risks, but if you can't list any risks for me, we do procedures every day that have some unknown risks to them, and you kind of have to weigh in your life what your choice is to be. But to let people who are, I often find people who are the healthiest are the ones that are the biggest protesters and haven't dealt with this every day. People should be able to make options that are relatively safe.
Yeah. Walk a mile in my shoes, Christine says again. Christine, I think that's the first blind mother-daughter call in, certainly around an issue like this that we've had. But I wish your family good luck with this. I hope the best works out for you. And I appreciate your call, Christine. Dr. Griffo, what's your projection? Where do you see this going 10 years down the road? Do you think this will be happening in the U.S.? You say it will happen in the U.K. What path do you project, foresee?
You know, I can't try and predict the time frame. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon because of the resistance and also the way, the inflammatory and caustic way it's presented, which is lacks empathy, and you heard it from three patients this morning. No one is listening to them, and it's really a tragedy. And it's more about anxiety and fear than it is about, you know, doing something good for a patient. The fact that, you know, mice have had this procedure done and it works, and that monkeys have done this procedure and it works, you know, that those facts are ignored, and some unpredictable side effect is what we're concerned about, and we should be concerned about it. But, you know, the first heart transplant patient died. Someone had to take the step. Someone had to take the risk. And no one's asking anybody in this room to take a risk. It's up to the patient. And if they're willing to take a risk and there's research to support it, why not? Well, or just make them suffer, or just tell them to adopt or do the egg donor. It's not so easy.
Big issues. Dr. James Griffo, Program Director at New York University Fertility Center. Dr. Griffo, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Marcy Darnofsky, are you being caustic and inflammatory, raising these bigger concerns?
You know, the FDA is not, I have a lot of criticisms of the FDA, but I want someone to be looking at the safety of the drugs that I take and my kids take, the procedures that I undergo and my family undergoes. I don't want, companies, researchers, or fertility doctors to be on their high horse about moving forward with things that aren't safe.
Marcy Darnofsky, we're out of time right there with the Center for Genetics and Society in Berkeley, California. Marcy, thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.